Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group from Miami, Florida. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink, since January 25th, 1981, and I'm grateful for that. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. that incredible ovation. I want to thank Bob D. Bob, thank you for, in the whatever the, if there is a committee, whoever was invited me, you're the committee, so I want to thank you for inviting. It's always good for me to be at an AA meeting. It's a privilege to be here, especially here among you guys. I'm not involved in Back to Basics. I'm into Back to Basics, and I'm this is my old beat up Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and what you might learn somewhere during this talk that I'm going to give is I'm stuck somewhere between 1935 and 1939, so I guess I'm pre-back to birth. I think back to basis because 1940 after, I'm somewhere between 35 and 39. I think AA started in 35, right? Big Book was written in 39, right? They said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, right? You do what we did, you'll get what we got. You'll experience much of heaven. You'll be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. You do what we did, you'll get what we got. And so somewhere around 15 or 16 years sobriety, when I was just thirsting for more, I got a hold of the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and I started reading specifically what they were doing. And I fell in love with what they were doing. I was ready to hear what they were doing. And that's what I've been doing for a long time now. I'm particularly happy to be able to have met some of the people here. Paul P., I've had a lot of conversation with him, and I'm glad I was here for Sam's 41st birthday. That's wonderful. I love old-timers. I thought I was one until I went to the International, and they're always moving the bar on me. You know, my sponsor said, I don't even consider you sober until you have 10 years. My first sponsor said, you're not even sober until you have 10 years. When I had 10 years, I said, I have 10 years. Now I said, I meant 20, you know, and... So I have like 34. It'll be 35 in January, God willing. And I went to the International. They had a booth for old timers. I figured, well, maybe I'll go up there. Maybe you get a mug or something. I don't know. And I said, so how much time I got 30. How much time do you need to be an old timer? So he's 40. You know. So I mean, it's always forget it. So I want to also. It was great to hear Patrick last night. I don't know whether he's here. Are you here, Patrick? They're great. Very moving. I loved it, and I got to go to a workshop today with Michael and Jeremy, and they did a great job on 6 and 7, which are two of my favorite steps, except for 3 and 11 and all the rest. And I'm a third-step guy. There's a little line in third-step that says, unless you practice this all the way through, all the steps, that's the basis for all the steps. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And all my friends, I have some friends here who came down from different parts of the country, so it's good to see them, and I just want to tell you how much I appreciate being here. So look, here's the deal. I'll just tell you, some people say I'm controversial. Every once in a while I mention Jesus or something. I might as well get that out of the way, so you don't go totally crazy or I say something about Scripture or something like that, but I'll try to keep it light. I'll tell you what the deal is. I've been road testing alcoholism, this little disease we have, sobriety for 34 years, almost 35 years now. I'm 66 years old. I came in when I was 31. I got a wife of 34 years. I've got 4 kids, 6 grandkids. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions most of the time. And so I've been dealing with the disease of alcoholism. I'm not talking about the symptom, that drinking thing, I'll talk a little bit about the drinking thing, but I'm not going to talk much about it. I mean, I don't know what to tell you if you don't think if you think I'm not an alcoholic, but I just decided to come here to do this thing. I used to drink alcohol. I'll go into that a little bit. And I think that's wonderful. I think Patrick did a wonderful job, and I'll qualify a little on that. But what I really do is I have a heart for not only new people, but I have a heart for old-timers. I have a heart for guys that have 10 years and 15 years and 20 years, because I sponsor a lot of guys with 20, 25. 15 years who are living lives of quiet desperation, who are sober, who are not drinking, but they're not being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. But they can't really talk about it at meetings because people think that they're okay. And they don't really want to talk about it because they got that pride thing going, and they're not even sure what the problem is anyway. And so I really have a heart for people that have time but are not experiencing the things that should be experienced by people when they pass from the boy to the man stage. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, my experiences during sobriety. That's what I really want to talk about. My mother, who was I was brought up in an alcoholic home. And, you know, I don't know how many of you guys were brought up in an alcoholic home. My mother was an alcoholic. And when you're in an alcoholic home at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's plates hitting the walls and yelling and screaming, all sorts of shit going on. I'm not blaming anything on my mom or anything like that. I would have been an alcoholic if I was brought up in Ozzie and Harriet. But the bottom line is it probably affects you somewhere on an emotional level or something like that. But I swore, and my mother was a self-pityaholic. You know, and believe me, I'm familiar with self-pity. She was a New York, you know, broad who would like to sit and drink scotch and feel sorry for herself and cry. And I said I would, and I swore I would never be like my mom. And I turned into mom, you know, and that's the deal on that deal. Let me tell you something. I know what it's like to wake up in the morning and say I'm not going to drink today, and by 5 o'clock in the afternoon I'm drinking. I know what it's like to wake up in the morning the next day and say I'm not going to buy any booze today and mean it, and by 5 o'clock in the afternoon I'm searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters so I can get up $2.89 and get to the Winn-Dixie and buy a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Chianti and sit by the record player. At that time, we're talking about 31 years ago, we had things called LP records. Some of you youngsters don't know what an LP record is. It's a big black thing. You know, I could have been a superstar with CDs, and I'd sit there and I'd play the same song over and over. You know, I play Alky songs. You guys know what Alky songs are, right? You know, like Only the Lonely, I'm Mr. Blue, Rainy Days and Mondays, anything by Karen Carpenter, you know, all that crap, you know, Running on Empty, that kind of crap. And I'd play the same song over and over again, and I'd think about me singing that song. I'd think about all the broads that screwed me over, and, you know, I'd think about my funeral. I think about my funeral a lot. I wasn't really dead. I was hiding behind a tree, and all those gals were there, you know, feeling sorry for them, you know, how they treated me and, you know, all that stuff. And I drank for the noble art of getting bombed. You know, some people needed excuses for drinking. You know, the car broke down, the wife, you know, awake was good enough for me. As long as I was awake, I was drinking. And I liked, you know, everything I did had to do with drinking. I thought I was a fisherman, but we'd go fishing. I'd say, who's bringing the booze? I was a golfer, who's playing golf, and who's bringing the booze? Let me tell you something. If we're going golfing, nobody's playing the booze, I'm not golfing. You know what I mean? It's all about the booze as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to, you know, and I just couldn't stop drinking. You know, I'm one of these guys, you know, I'm not going to go to the bar today, and I'd end up in the bar. And finally, I just gave up. I said, you know, I said, I'm not, I was 31 years old. I thought my life was over. It would never going to be better again. I couldn't envision a life without drinking. And in any event, that I got married. I went to law school and graduated law school, got married to a gorgeous gal, wonderful gal, you know, and from a beautiful family. She's a sweetheart, nothing wrong with her, you know, and I was whatever age, I can't remember the age at this point. I've got that Alzheimer's thing going. I don't know what it is, you know. But in any event, I married this beautiful gal, and I got a job with the DA's office, and I was a major crimes prosecutor at district attorney for many years, and did mostly murder cases and sex batteries and things like that. And it was a great job, you know, a great job for an egotistical, crazy guy like me. And I had a beautiful wife and a beautiful house, and I had everything. I was an if only and a yes butter. You know, if only I had this, you know, if only I had that, if only I had the car, if only I had the gal, if only I had the house, if only I had making more money, if only I was always looking, I always had to have something. I knew there was just something missing. If I got this thing, I'd get the thing I needed, I'd be okay for 15 seconds, you know. And I mean, one of the best stories, I was an alcoholic. What I learned, as you guys know, because alcohol drinking, what I didn't, you know, you come in here because how many people came in here because they wanted to stop drinking? I came in here because I wanted to stop drinking. You know, that's what I thought, you know, that's what I thought AA was about. I mean, the name sort of gives it away, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, after I came in here, I stopped drinking, and I realized that alcohol really was just a symptom of the disease. I had alcoholism before I even came to Alcoholics Anonymous, before I even started drinking. My favorite story about that, I've got a million stories about that, is I remember when I was about 18 or 19 or 20 years old, I'd inherited some money, and back then it was like 1971 or something like that. When I was about 15 or 16, I discovered something called Playboy Magazine. Anybody ever see Playboy Magazine? So, you know, you're the one you read like that, you know, and I saw that deal, and I knew what the answer to my problems were. I knew if I could have one of those things in my life, I would be okay. Now, I don't know where I got this idea. It's probably from the world or the billboards or whatever it is, but I knew in order to get one of those things, I had to get one of them car. I had to have certain things because, you know, now I didn't say this to myself, but I guess deep down inside, I knew I was a piece of shit. You know, Carl Menninger wrote a book called Man Against Himself in the 1930s, and he said on the chapter on alcoholism, he said alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. Because deep down inside, they hate themselves. Now, I don't understand where that's coming from, but I know alcoholics sit around judging themselves and condemning themselves all the time. And I know if you're an alcoholic like me, you sit around and you tell yourself every 5 seconds you don't give a shit what other people think about you. I don't give a shit what they think about me. I don't care what they think about me. I don't give a crap what they think about me. And somewhere along the line, when you stay sober for a while, you understand that people who either voice, either say, and I used to say it out loud, I don't give a shit what they think about me, or even think, I don't give a shit what they think about me, spend their entire lives worrying about what other people think about them. Because you see, people who don't really give a shit what other people think about them don't say, I don't give a shit what other people think about them. They say things like pass the ketchup, but they don't say that shit. You understand what I'm saying? So when you worry about what other people think about you, the reason you do that is because you think you're a piece of shit. Now, I'm not talking about you guys because I can tell you guys are sort of like a cut above. I'm talking about guys like me. You understand what I'm saying? By the way, that's alcoholism. That's the real alcoholism. That's what you deal with after you stop the fucking drinking. Unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious and true happiness he'll find none at all. And I don't know about you, but I don't want any precarious sobriety. And I got in this thing in order to be happy, not sad, not feeling sorry for myself, not to be a thumb-sucking crybaby. And so what I'm going to talk about is that stuff. So in any event, what I did is one of the things that happens is one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is you think you need something. You think you actually need to get stuff in order to be okay, and you need to have certain things in your life and, you know, a certain amount of money, a certain amount of this, that, and the other thing. And so I knew they had come out with the new Camaros. And I knew if I could get one of these new Camaros, these new slate-back Camaros and Firebirds that came out, if I get one, I'd be able to have that gal, that bunny, that gal. I'd be okay. I'd be, you know, just as good as. So I took the money that I'd gotten, and I ran down to Potemkin Chevrolet down on Alton Road in Miami Beach, and there was a brand-new gold Camaro with a Landau top. They don't have Landau tops anymore. Back then, they had Landau tops. Some of you guys know what that is, like a vinyl top. It looked gorgeous. It was unbelievable. I knew if I had that car, I'd be okay. If only I had that car, I'd be okay. And believe me, I've spent more money I don't have, you know, buying shit I don't need to impress people I don't like than you could possibly imagine, okay? So you know, I don't even think of that. I don't know, how can I make all this money and always be broke? Because, you know, when you have a low self-opinion of self, you need a lot of shit to be okay, you know? And you worry about stuff, you know? And so I ran down there to get that car, and I put down whatever the money was to get that car, you know, most of the money, but I had a finance son. And I said, okay, give me that car. And they said, no, we can't give it to you. We can't give it to you, he says, because we got to prep it. Apparently there's some sort of prepping or something. It's the law. I said, no, I don't give, forget, you know, because I want it. I'm an alcoholic. I want it now. He says, no, forget the prepping. You know, he says, no, we got to prep it. But if you come back tomorrow, Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, we'll give you the car. We'll have it all prepped. So I was there at like 8:30. You know, and I'm waiting, and I grab that car, and I get in that car. It's got like 100 miles on it. It's that new car smell. It's absolutely gorgeous. I roll those windows down. I was smoking cigarettes at that time. I got a cigarette in my mouth. I got my shades on. You know, I was so cool. I was like frosty. I was like, you know, I was like, you know, 400 degrees below Fahrenheit. And I'm rolling out of that thing. I got the window down. You know, I got my hand out the window. I'm driving down Alton Road. There's nobody on the road. It's Saturday morning at like 9 o'clock. I thought I was driving through Yankee Stadium. You know, I thought the whole world, I thought all the women in China were looking at me. You know, I'm looking. I said, look at this. I'm in the car. I drive up to the first light. I stop at the first light. I'm sitting there in the car. I'm okay now. Everything's wonderful. Some guy pulls up next to me, to my right, in a brand new Cadillac. Some some old fart, you know, some guy's, you know, he's probably like my age now, you know, his 60s or something. And he's in a brand new Cadillac. And I look at him, and he looks at me. And I look at him, and he looks at me. And I look at him, and sitting next to him is the Playboy fucking bunny. And he looks at me. And I think to myself, why can't I have a car like that? The feeling lasted 3 blocks. The payments lasted 36 months, and that's the story of my life. And you know what that is, by the way? That's alcoholism. That's what you deal with on every. That's what you deal with after you stop drinking. That's what you dealt with before you stopped drinking. That's why you drank. Restless, irritable, and discontented. That's my deal. Now, I didn't know this because when you feel that way and you are that way all the time, your entire life, you don't know you're that way because that's just the way you are. I told my sponsor once when he said to me, why do you do the things you do? Why do you say the crap you say? I said, well, that's just my personality. He says, well, your personality's killing you. How do you get rid of your personality? I mean, I've had it all my life. You know, he says, you better change. You better have some sort of psychic change and change your personality. So in any event, I married this gorgeous gal, remember her, and gave me a beautiful son. I got everything together. I got a great job, top job in Miami. You know, one of the top prosecutors there got a great job. You know, got a beautiful house on Miami Beach, on Alton Road, right on the golf course. You know, everything's perfect. Great in-laws. Everything is wonderful. You know, and every night or so, I go over to the bar with the rest of the homicide prosecutors and the detectives, homicide detectives, and we'd be drinking. And I wasn't a screwing around on my wife. I was just thinking about screwing around on my wife. I just said, you know, I was a good guy. I was a loyal husband, and I just sat around drinking, look at all the broads, thinking about getting laid, but not having the guts to do it. You know, but thinking of what it would be like, because, you know, already, you know what she was like? She was a great gal. She was a beautiful gal. She was a wonderful gal, but, you know, she was like that damn Camaro. And I wanted a Cadillac. Yeah. I wanted a different car. Yeah. You know, now I'm not, I'm telling you this now after 34 years sobriety, looking at myself and who I was. This is not like I was thinking like that now. All I knew is that I wanted to be at that bar, looking at those broads, doing that deal, and I was stuck with that gal over there who was waiting dinner for me. And so I used to come home every night, you know, she's waiting dinner for me and all that sort of stuff, and I'd roll in around 3 o'clock in the morning. And one day, when I was about 5 years married, my wife came up to me, my first wife, actually call her my first wife, we number them if you're an alcoholic, and she said to me these words, 12 words, I'll never forget them. She walked up to me, she wasn't starting an argument, she was carrying my son, my small son, and she said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. If you come home drunk one more time, I am leaving you. 12 words. No fat. I mean, I don't think you could take one word out of that deal. It was like she was delivering the mail. You know what I mean? If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving with you. And I looked at her, and I got in my car. I drove 3 or 4 blocks to a red light, and I stopped. And this, I swear, this is what I said to myself. What the hell did she mean by that? You know what I've learned about myself and working with alcoholics? Whenever an alcoholic hears, sees, or is told something he doesn't like, it confuses him. He gets mad, he gets pissed off, and he forgets about it. That's why when you go to the court and the judge says, I see you one more time, I'm putting you under the fucking jail, you know what I mean? And you walk out and you say, what the fuck was that all about? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you can be the most great. Let me tell you something. I graduated Departmental Honors in Mathematics, got a National Science Foundation Fellowship. You know, I mean, I had all this stuff going for me. Division Chief, I didn't have a clue. I got to tell you something. When, no matter how smart you are, no matter how good an artist you are, no matter how talented you are, when somebody says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, and you say, what the hell they mean by that, you're going to have some trouble. You understand what I'm saying? There's a piece missing. There's like a disconnect somewhere. And guess what? And you know what happened? I went over to the bar. I met my drinking buddies, the Alibi Lounge. You know, my bar, because, you know, if you're a bar drinker like me, we have our own bar. It's my bar. You know the kind of bar you go to if they change the seating arrangement, why didn't they talk to you first? You know, you feel like you own it. I sat by the bar, and I told my friend, but I remembered what she said. I said to Doug, I can't stay. I got to leave because Ronnie says if I come home drunk one more time, she's leaving you. And he says, well, I need so much. And he puts his arm around me because, don't you love drinking? He says, she loves you. You're the greatest guy in the world. I said, you're right. I am the greatest guy in the world. She does love me. But I got to leave. So I ordered my first drink. It's double scotch. I realized like 5 years later, I was already working on two drinks. I ordered a double scotch and I drank it. Like, this is how I drank. I got the scotch, I drank it, I went whack, gone. Because I drank for the I drank for the feeling. I drank for the effect. I wanted to get to that. You know what I wanted to get to? I wanted to get to that spot where I really didn't give a shit. Because when you spend your whole life giving a shit about everything that's going on around you, you want to get to that spot. And that's what a booze, it'll get to that spot where you really don't give a crap. You know, and that's a spot to get to. You know, and I drank that drink, and then somehow it made sense. You could, so now I'm looking at the clock. It's 4:30. I'm only 15 minutes away from my house. You know, and now I go whack it down. Now it's 4:30 and 30 seconds. So I had one more drink. Next thing you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. He's taking me home, and that's the end of my marriage. That's the end of a 5-year marriage. He kicked me out of the house. As I'm walking to my car, you know what I'm saying to myself? I'm saying I'm free. I'm free. I'm free. I'm free to go to the bar. I was never free not to go to the bar. I'm free. I walked away from that marriage, dropped that wife, dropped that kid, dropped, you know, here's this poor girl. She's thinking it's for love, honor, obey forever. And I'm thinking that kind of shit, and I'm thinking it's disposable. I can't wait to get out of that deal, walking away from my wife and my kid, thinking I'm a nice, you know, one of the stories I tell, which is true, lest you think I'm actually a nice guy, during the pendency of the divorce, because she was a decent gal, she said, let's go to marriage counseling to try to patch this up. I was already screwing around in the bars. And, you know, you ever see that Godfather movie, Godfather 3, where Al Pacino says, I got out and they dragged me back in. So I agreed to go to the marriage counselor, you know, I guess out of guilt, you know, because I felt I had to do it. And I felt I was being dragged back into the marriage. She was dragging me back. And I didn't want to drag, because I wanted to go to the bar. I wanted to leave my son, my wife. I wanted to go to the bar and get laid. And the bottom line is, so I go into the marriage counselor. The marriage counselor asked my first wife, she says, I guess they teach this in marriage counselor school. I don't know. He says, okay, what are the three things you want to change about Russell? Well, I'd like him to come home for dinner, and I'd like him to stop drinking, and I'd like whatever. I wasn't paying attention. She was saying, stump. Now, all I knew is that if this thing worked, I was back in the cage again. And then he turned to me and he said, so Russell, how do you want to change Ronnie? You know, what do you want to change as far as Ronnie? And I looked at him and I said, I just want to date other women. That was the end of the session. How do you think that affected her? How would that affect you? You think I gave a shit? You know why? Because I'm not only powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over my mouth. I'm powerless over my mouth. I'm powerless over hatred. I'm powerless over resentment. I'm powerless over a lot of things. But I know that because that's just the way I am. I just think something, feel something, want to do something, I just do it. And tell people that I'm really a nice guy, I'm really a good guy, you don't understand, because at least I paid my child support. So we got a divorce, and I started on my real plan was to become the Hugh Hefner of Miami, which because of bad breaks and misunderstandings didn't quite work out, you know? because when you can't stop drinking, it gets pretty bad, and it got pretty bad, and one day, I'm going to skip forward because I want to get to the sober part. I want to get to the recovery part. So one day on Christmas of 1980, a young lady invited me to go to something called Noche Buena. It's Cuban families have this thing on Christmas Eve where they roast a pig and all sort of stuff. This gal, you know, invited me to this Noche Buena. And so I went there, you know, half sloshed because, you know, I had to lubricate in order to get there. And once I get there, I'm drinking. So by 8 o'clock, I'm already gone. And her father says, you know, get him out of here. And they kicked me out and I went home. So there I was on Christmas Eve, drunk in my apartment, my bachelor pad, all by myself, you know, on Christmas Eve. And as I told you, I'm a self-pityaholic too. And the bottom was coming up pretty fast. I mean, I had already tried to stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop. It got worse and worse and worse and worse. I'd lost everything. I'd lost it. You know, I still had a job and all that sort of stuff. But you know what I really lost is I lost me. I lost my self-respect. I lost who and what I was. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, TV goes on. You know, this is where the J word comes in. The TV comes on. And this guy comes on. Now, 34 years ago, when the TV went on at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's Christmas. Let me tell you something. It was a pastor. You understand what I'm saying? And it happened to be a guy who was giving a test. You know how we give testimony here? Like I'm giving my testimony now? That's what he was doing. He wasn't doing the preaching thing. He was saying, this is what I was like. It was, you know, like it was like the cross and the switchblade kind of thing. He was giving testimony. He was telling his story. And he was a guy who came from a bad situation. He was talking about, if you want to change your life, man, I want to change my life. And he said, get down on your knees and give your life to Jesus. I got down on my knees. I said the sinner's prayer. I gave my life to Jesus, which may not sound like a big thing to you, but for a Jewish kid from New York, it is. Now, let me tell you something. You know, a lot of guys say to me, well, if they had done the God thing with me when I came in, I wouldn't have come in. When you are desperate, you'd be surprised at what you do. And I was desperate. I wanted a change. I wanted something to happen. I got down on my knees. Now, I thought for a long time nothing really happened because I continued to drink. And then about 30 days later, I got into a bad car accident, you know, in a blackout because I drove in a blackout. You know, I did one of these things, you know, you're driving along and you wake up and you're looking around to see who's driving the car and you're going 70 miles per hour, 995. You say, who's driving the car? And you realize you're the only guy there. You know what I mean? You're the only guy in the car, you know, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I mean, alcoholism is a tough deal. You know, you're in the shower lathering up and, you know, you hear a voice, you're a piece of shit, you're an asshole. And you turn around to say who's saying it, who's telling you that, and you're the only guy in the shower. The voices, you know. You know what that is, by the way? That's alcoholism. That's alcoholism. You can stop the drinking. How are you going to stop the thinking? How are you going to stop the voices when they tell you you're a piece of shit and you might as well be dead? You'll never be okay. You're fooling everybody, and once they find out who you are, they're going to kick you out because you're a piece of crap and you're worthless and you're just a bum. How are you going to stop that crap? How are you going to be rocking in the fourth dimension of existence and try to love other people when you think you're a piece of crap and you're not worthy to live? You know, you can stop the drinking. How are you going to stop that deal? How do you get rid of that deal when you've had that deal all your life from the time you were a sperm on up? You know, I don't know what the deal is, but in any event, that day, I got into an accident. I almost got killed. A bunch of things happened, and finally somebody came over to my bed, and I looked him in the eye. My boss came over to my bed, and I looked him in the eye, and this is what I said. This is exactly what I said. I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. That's what I said. It may not sound like the first step to you. It may not say, well, my name's Russell. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. That's what it was. I said, I need help. Maybe a month before, I would have said, I need a new girlfriend. A month before, I might have said, I need some more money. I need a different job. But that I might have had all sorts of problems, okay? But by that time, my life had become, every problem, my life had become a bottle. I had become a bottle. That's the whole thing, a bottle. And the only thing I saw was the drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. I didn't see any other problem except I could not stop drinking. And I looked at this man and I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I did relay for 8 years in Dade County. If you called up on any Friday night between 11 and 8 o'clock the next morning, you got me, which is probably why nobody got sober after 8 years. I mean, it's a wonderful job to have. You know, you learn real fast. I would spend hours with a drunk on the phone and then, you know, listen to all sorts of bullshit because they were lonely. And then after 3 hours, I'd say to them, well, now about this drinking thing. And they'd say, I don't want to stop drinking, you know. And, you know, you learn very fast how to ask the question after about 2 minutes saying, do you want to stop drinking? And you listen to a lot of bullshit and you listen to a lot of crap, you know. One guy called me up once and said, well, I'm out on 34th Street, and I really need to go to detox, and I need some help. And I said, well, you know, you're only 20 blocks away. If you start walking now, you'll get there by sunset. He says, well, what is that? I said, well, this isn't a taxi cab company. A detox is about 20 blocks away. Walk east, and you'll get there, detox. He says, what's your name? Russell. Well, your full name. He says, just tell them Russell. They know I've been doing this for 8 years. He says, I said, you're not gonna report me, are you? Because I wouldn't want to lose this job. One gal calls me up, she calls up Alcoholics Anonymous, she says, look, I'm a PhD in nursing, I have a little child that was sober for a year, and I started drinking, I really need help. He says, but don't talk to me about AA. I don't want to hear about AA. And I said, well, look, I said, I got one problem. I said, you know, my name's Russell, and I've been sober for about, you know, 6-7 years now. And I said, here's the problem. He says, number one, I got sober in AA. I said, that's number one. And number two, I don't know what plan B is, because the only plan I know is Alcoholics Anonymous. And number three, Miss PhD, you called Alcoholics Anonymous. but let me tell you something. Every once in a while, you get this phone. You know why I did it? Because every once in a while, you get this phone call. This is what I live for. The phone call where the guy calls up and says this. Hi. I says, what can I do for you? He says, I need help. I can't stop drinking. And then he shuts up. He doesn't say a word. You know why he doesn't say a word? Because he's waiting to hear what you're going to tell him, because whatever you say, he's going to do. You say, meet me at this meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning or something like that, he's going to be there. He's just waiting to hear the answer because he's ready, and nothing you say is going to scare him away. You say, meet me at this church, he's coming because he needs help. He can't stop drinking. He's desperate. He wants this more than anything else in the world. So in any event, that's what I said to the guy, and they brought me to my first AA meeting, and I don't remember much about it, you know, but all I remember is one thing. There were about 50, 60 people in the room. I walked in there. I looked around, you know, and I felt I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know anything about AA, but I just somehow knew. I had the feeling that I was going to be okay. You know, I just had the feeling that, you know, they were all happy. They were all laughing, and I thought I was going to be okay. And and I guess you do the same thing here. I don't know what you do. They lifted up this white chip for a desire to stop drinking, and I got up, and I walked past the 50 people, and I picked up that white chip. And you want to know something? You know what that is? Sometimes I say, and I really mean this, that I thought I was at my humblest at that point. I've been trying to get back to that deal for the last 34 years. When I knew nothing, and I stood up in front of 50 strangers who didn't even know me, and I didn't know them, and I basically sort of said, I'm the newest guy in the room, and I need help, and I'm stupid, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I walked past those 50 people, and I picked up that white chip. You know, sometimes I think, you know, that's when I was at my best. If I could somehow get to that deal again at 34 years, you know what I mean? That would be something else. I wasn't trying to impress anybody. I just knew exactly what was going on and I needed help. And so I picked up white chip and I got a sponsor, and they hooked me up with the wrong guy. You know how it was. I really, you know, based upon my pedigree, I really needed to be hooked up with Albert Einstein and, you know, or Jesus or something like that. But he wasn't available, so they gave me this used car salesman from Chicago who didn't even graduate to sixth grade. And there was obviously some big cosmic mistake or something like that. But I wasn't doing too well. I couldn't really sort of fight the thing. I had two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. You know, if I started a conversation with you, I'd forget what I was going to say during the middle of it. And he didn't understand me. I used to tell him a lot. I said, you don't understand, you know, and I used to use that terminology a lot. And he told me a couple of things. I'll tell you a couple of deals on that. He told me he wanted me. He said, I'll be your sponsor. He said, but here's the deal. He says, here's a 24-hour book, and I want you to read it every morning and ask God's help to stay sober on your knees. And I don't remember him asking me whether I believed in God. But yeah, I was in no position to argue, so I did that religiously for 20 years. And it got to the point where I was scared not to do it because I was staying sober, and I somehow connected my getting down on my knees and asking God's help to stay sober and reading that book with staying sober. And I didn't want to take the chance that, you know, that wasn't working there. And he said, I want you to call me before. He says, call me before you take the first drink. He says, don't call me after. I won't pick up. Call me before you take the first drink. And, I did that once. I got in a fight with my wife, and I was going to drink. I was going to show that bitch, you know, and I was going to drink at her. But I called him up. I dialed him up, and he said, ring, ring. Nobody answered. And I called him, ring, ring. Nobody answered. He said, ring, ring. Nobody answered. I called five times. Ring, ring. Nobody answered. Then I could call him up. Busy, busy. I couldn't. I just hang up the damn phone. I called him up the next day. I said, you told me. You said, call you up before I take the first drink. I dialed you. You didn't answer. I dialed you again. You didn't answer. I dialed you again. I dialed you again. It was a busy signal. You didn't even answer the phone. He says, did you drink? He says, no. I said, well, no, I didn't drink. He said, you see, it works. I don't know. And then he said, join a group. So I went over to the South Day group. He says, try the South Day group. So I go to the South Day group, And I sit in the back of the room. You know, there's like 40 people there. I sit in the back of the room. I'm watching. They're all tables. They all got their little cliques. You know how they all sit together. They all know each other. They're like you guys. They're high-fiving each other like they know each other from being, you know. And I'm all alone. I'm a new guy. I'm in the back of the room. I don't know anybody or anything like that. And they start the meeting, and they're, you know, they're saying, Fred, why don't you, Fred, what do you have to say? Joe. And like nobody comes up to me. Nobody, you know, introduces them. They say, I'm waiting for them to, you know, call on me so I can explain to them how I'm the emperor of AA or, you know, I should be the leader or something. Nobody asks. Nobody calls on me. I'm sitting there. I'm saying this. What bullshit? I mean, this is bullshit. Love and understanding, tolerance. What is this crap? You know, I'm sitting here. I'm a new guy. Nobody comes up to me. Nobody calls on me. None of this stuff is going on. This AA stuff is a bunch of bullshit. It's a bunch of crap and everything. Nobody says anything. It's just a bunch of cliques. All they care about is themselves, their own little friends. The meeting ends. I leave. I go up to my son. She says, so how'd you like the meeting? I said, it's a bunch of bullshit. Yeah. Group's full of crap. You know what I mean? They got their little cliques there. I stood there. Nobody came up to me. Nobody said anything to me. Nobody asked me how I was. They didn't ask me to talk or anything like that. He said, oh, okay. He says, well, listen, this is what I want you to do. I said, what? He says, I want you to go back there. I want you to join one of the cliques. I said, I'm sorry, what? He said, I want you to go back there. I want you to join one of the cliques. Go up to one of those cliques. I want you to join. I said, well, what are you kidding me? I said, he says, that's what I want you to do. So, you know, I went back there and I went up to one of the tables and I said, hi, my name's Russell. I'm alcoholic. I'm pretty new. He says, hey, come on, sit down. So I sat down. He says, you want some coffee? He said, sure. They got me some coffee. He says, hey, why don't you do the meeting? I said, well, okay, I says, well, I'll show you how. So I did the meeting or whatever the heck. I have no idea what I said or what I did. After the meeting, they came up and he says, hey, that was great. Keep coming back. I went over to my sponsor. He says, how'd you like the group? He says, that's a great fucking group. They must have brought in a whole new bunch of people. I don't know what happened. I don't know what the deal is. They were just absolutely great. Just shows you how, you know, if your actions change, how your perception can change. So one time I brought my sponsor comes to my office. You know, he didn't really respect. He used to call me counselor, but like with a sneer, he'd say, how you doing, counselor? You know, and I don't know how to explain. I can't say it the way he did, but it was like, how you doing, asshole? You know what I mean? And as a matter of fact, I've had three sponsors because, you know, that you know people say, well, you'd be my temporary sponsor. I'm not going to make it permanent because they all die with long sobriety and everything like that. But this guy was great, and he used to call me counselor, and, you know. So he came to my office once, and I have a wall with, like, about 30 different diplomas on, all sorts of degrees, diplomas, and everything like that, all sorts of stuff, attesting that I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. So he's sitting there in front of me, and this is what he says. This is what I say to him. I said, Bob. He says, what? He says, these are my degrees. And he looks at me. I'll never forget. He looks at me. He says, you know, Russell, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. So, you know, when you're sponsored, you know, so unfortunately, you know, when you're abused, I was abused, you know. He abused me, you know, and unfortunately, you know what happens to abused kids? They become abused. I became an abuser myself, you know, and that's it. You didn't quite understand. I told him once, I said, you know, I'm sensitive. He says, you know, Russ, no, great artists are sensitive. You're just touchy. It's different, you know. So I wanted to, you know, one of the stories, he sponsored a guy named Bobby. You know, this is kind of, you got to follow this. His name is Bob, and he sponsored a guy named Bobby. He was a litter mate with me. It was me, and there was Bobby. Now, I happen to be one of these guys that pick up a white chip, and I haven't found necessarily have a drink, you know, since I did that. I mean, I could drink an hour from that. I mean, I'm powerless over alcohol. I don't know how to explain that. Alcoholics understand it. Most normal people don't understand it. I'm powerless over alcohol. I absolutely believe I could be drunk. If I lose my spiritual connection to God, who keeps me sober, I could be drunk in a half an hour. I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt about the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol, even though I haven't had a drink in 34 years. And I have no doubt that I have alcoholism. I have alcoholism even now, sitting here right now. I know what alcoholism is. I know what it looks like. I know I deal with it. I've been road testing it. I've been dealing with it in my life on a daily basis. I know what it looks like at 15 years sober. I know what it looks like at 34 years sober. You know, that's why people will ask you, when you haven't had a drink, they'll say, you still have to go to those meetings? Because they think alcoholism has to do with drinking. They don't know it has to do with being crazy. They don't understand that. I sponsored a guy once, and he said, a guy named Tommy, he was a drinking buddy of mine, and he came in, and he had, man, I'll tell you, he was a mess, you know. He was coked out, drunk, unbelievable. It was a bad deal. And I got him into AA, took him to his first AA meeting, and he took to it like a duck takes to water. He stopped drinking. He stopped the whole thing. He went crazy. He went to AA meetings. He just went. It was just fantastic. It was like overnight fantastic. He wasn't drinking. 3 months later, I get a call from him. He says, I think I have to leave AA. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I think I have to leave AA. He says, Tommy, you love AA. You're doing great in AA. Why, have you had a drink? He says, no. He says, but I think I have to leave. He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. He said, what do you mean you don't think you're an alcoholic? You're sleeping on a probation officer's floor. You know, you're almost disbarred. You can't stop doing coke and alcohol. You come to AA. I mean, you've been saying you're an alcoholic for 3 months. What do you mean? He says, no, Russ. He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. He says, listen. He says, I just think I may be crazy. And I said, Tommy. He says, what? I says, Tommy. He says, what? You can be both. He said, really? I said, absolutely. You know what I mean? You know why? Because he had started thinking. He had started doing that crazy, you know, committee shit. You know, he thought that maybe he was just nuts, you know. And And so there was Bob and Bobby, you understand? So we're driving up to, so what happened with me is I stopped drinking, but Bobby, every 30 days would be drinking. He would get sober, he'd sober up, and then every 30 days, he was like one of those guys that he would say things like, I'm coming on that time again. You know, he had like a timer. Every 30 days, bam, we'd have to pick him up at bark. He'd be drinking. He'd be doing great, and then on the 29th day, he disappears. And Bob and I would go up to BARC, which is the Broward Alcohol, you know, Recruitment Center or whatever, you know, rehab center. We'd pick him up. Bob would dust him off. You know, he'd be sober. He'd detox. He'd get him a room. He'd get him some clothes. He'd take him to meetings, and we'd start all over again. This happened every 30 days for about 3 months. You know what I mean? 3 or 4 months. And it was getting to the point where I'm watching this thing, and the more I'm watching it, the more pissed I am, because my poor sponsor, who only has like about 20 years at the time, doesn't understand this guy's a phony piece of crap. He's using him. It's a bunch of bullshit. I mean, I could see it. It was clear to me. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm gathering the evidence. I got 3x5 cards. I got photographs. I got the whole bit. I got the facts on my side. You know what I mean? I am Alky Wright. If you disagree with me, you should be killed because you're so fucking stupid. You know what I mean? And the bottom line is, so what happens is we're driving up to pick him up at BARC. And I'm saying to him, I say, Bob, we ought to turn this thing around. I said, this guy is full of crap. He's a phony. He's using you. He's using me. He did this last month. He did this the month before last month. He did the month before. We've done this 4 times. He does the same thing all the time. You pick him up. He says he's going to be okay. He drinks again. We ought to turn this car around. And the more I'm talking, the angrier I'm, you know, I'm like my own lynch mob. We ought to get him. Kill him, as a matter of fact. Let's get him. And, you know. And he says, I had the charts, I had the 3x5. I mean, what can I say? I'm a lawyer, I'm a prosecutor. He's like, he hasn't even graduated grade school. I mean, I'm telling him what the facts are. I'm trying to save his life. And you know, I'm yelling, I'm screaming. And finally, I tire myself out. And he looks at me, he says, are you done? I said, yeah, but I wasn't, because now I had a lynch mob in my mind. I said, yeah. He says, no. He says, are you done? I said, yeah. He says, yeah, I'm done. He said, listen. I said, what? What's he going to say? What can he say? I mean, I was right. I mean, the truth is, I was right. He was a phony. I says, are you done? I said, I am. He says, listen. I said, what? He said, listen. I said, what? He said, Russell. I said, what? This is what he said. Now listen to this. This is important. He looked at me and he said, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. You know what the problem was? I wanted everything he had. He wanted nothing I had. He used to have what I had. He didn't want it back again. You know why? Because what I had was something called alcoholism, which can't be registered on a breathalyzer test. He said, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. You know what I said to him? I said, how could it not bother you? Everything bothers me. Everything bothers me. The guy in the Cadillac bothers me. My former wife bothered me. The entire world fucking bothers me. Sitting in this car bothers me. 9 years later. I'm 9 years sober. I'm doing steps all over the place. I'm sponsoring people. I'm doing this thing by the numbers. By the numbers. By the numbers, buddy. And my wife did what, my second wife, I married another, I've been married for 34 years, 4 kids. She's a card, she's a member of Al-Anon, our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge. You know, when I'm wrong, she does a great Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it, you know, and... I have a little 5-year-old granddaughter. One of my granddaughters, they're cute as a bunny. She comes into my office, my home office, and I'm working on the computer, and she says, Grandpa, I said, what, honey? He says, what kind of fish are you? I said, I'm sorry, Andrea. What? She says, what kind of fish are you? I said, what kind of fish am I? He says, yeah, what kind of fish are you? I said, well, I don't know, honey. What kind of fish am I? You're a selfish. I said, have you been talking to you were talking to Grandma, haven't you? He says, yeah, absolutely. You know, so she's turning them, you know. So in any event, but she does. You know how they act. You know what they do. You know they say their shit and they do their stuff and they spend that money and they do that deal and they tell you you're always wrong and you take out the garbage. She says you take out the garbage and the next day she says you never take out the fucking garbage and they drive you nuts and they do that shit. You know how it is. You come home one day. You're tired. You've been working all damn day. And it's 8 o'clock at night and you're dead tired and you go over to the refrigerator. You know, to get a drink, and all of a sudden from the bedroom, you hear her say something like, "We're out of milk." You say, We're out of fucking. You just got in, we're out of milk. You're sitting on your ass all day, you can't get the milk. You know, the one fucking thing that I want you to get is the milk, you can't get the milk. And even worse than that, you know what I don't like? With the gals? Here's what I don't like. She doesn't even have the human decency to say, "Honey, would you possibly get the milk or something like that?" And some sort of, would you get the milk? No, she's got to do this manipulative woman, female crap. "Honey, we're out of milk." Like, I don't know what she's doing there with that deal. Like, "We're out of milk. Why don't you get the milk?" And, you know, that kind of crap. And I can't even believe it. I have to go. So I got to get in the car. I go out. I get the milk. I throw the milk in the refrigerator. She comes out. She says, "What the hell's wrong with you?" He says, "The fuck of me, you can't get the milk. You had all day to get the milk. You had to do this bullshit with the habanero." And I yell at her, she yells at me, the cops come, I try to tell them about the milk, they don't even understand. Fucking milk. I mean, you guys understand, but they didn't understand. And my daughter, they just wanted fucking milk. They didn't give a shit what I thought, how I felt. But you know, when you're an alcoholic, you may not worship God, but you worship your emotions and your feelings. They're the most important things. Yeah, I killed your dog and I raped your wife, but you shouldn't have fucking said that to me. You pissed me off. And, you know, by the way, you know what that is? That's alcoholism. That's stuff you do when you're sober. So she had done one of those things. So I called up my sponsor, my then sponsor, Joe Snyder, and I told him about that wife of mine and, you know, whatever she, however long we had in them, we were married 10 years or 9 years. And how I had to leave her, and it's my way or the highway, and I can't take this shit. You know, listen, I'm an AA, but I got sober. I'm a good husband. I'm sober. I do this stuff, and this is the bullshit she pulls on me, and this is the crap, and this is the damn. And I go to that, and he says this to me. He says, "Russell, let me ask you something." I said, "What?" He said, "Do you know why you're upset?" That's all he said. He said, "Do you know why you're upset? Is anybody in here, raise your hand if you've been upset in the last 6 months?" Okay, now let me ask you this. Now listen. Listen, when you're upset, you knew why you're upset, right? I mean, if there's anything an alcoholic knows, it's why he's upset. I mean, you can go to an AA room and say, "You wouldn't believe my wife did." You can tell them why you're upset, right? If there's one thing you know without any question is why you're upset and what happened, right? So he says, "Do you know why you're upset?" I said, "Of course I know why I'm upset." He says, "Why are you upset?" I said, "Joe, I just spent the last 20 minutes telling you an entire conversation, what she said and what I said and what happened. I just told you why I'm upset." He said, "That's not why you're upset." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "That's not why you're upset." I said, "That whole thing I told you about the spending money and what she said, that's not why you're upset." I said, "That's not why I'm upset." He said, "That's not why you're upset. That whole thing, that's not why I'm upset." He says, "That's not it." And then he shut up. He didn't say a word. He didn't tell me this is why you're upset. He didn't, you know, because he knew I'm an alcoholic. As soon as he told me, I'd say that's fucking bullshit. He didn't say a word. So, you know, if there's anything I'm interested in, it's me, because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, stepping on the toes of others. All I care about is me. All I think about is me. All I want to talk about is me. So now this guy's saying, "That's not why you're upset," and he's not talking to me. And so what did I say? I said, "Well, do you know why I'm upset?" He said, "Of course I know why you're upset." I said, "You know why I'm upset?" He said, "Of course I know why you're upset." I said, "Well, are you going to tell me why I'm upset?" He says, "Do you really want to know?" I said, "Of course I want to know. Why am I upset?" And this is what he says. He says, and this is exactly the way he said it. He said, "Listen, stupid." Because he loved me, you know? Well, you know, that it's true. You know, alcoholics, especially alcoholic men, are strange. You know, guys I sponsor, you say, "You are the dumbest asshole I've ever seen in my life. You know, go to the meeting and shut the hell up." And they walk away saying, "Oh, he still loves me." You know what I mean? And I don't understand how that works, but it's some sort of man thing. He said, "That's not why you're upset." He says, He said, you're going to tell me why I'm upset? I said, yeah. He said, listen, stupid. He said, you're upset because you're upsettable. So what is this, like Zen AA or something? You know, I want you to listen to this. He said the same exact thing to me at 9 years sober after working this program that my first sponsor said when I had 4 months. You remember what Bobby said, what Bob said to me? I told him about the facts that were happening on the ground, which were absolutely true. The exact facts were absolutely true. There was nothing wrong with what I said. I was absolutely right. Remember what he said to me? And I was going nuts and I was crazy. You remember what he said? He said, it doesn't bother me. I know what you're talking about. You're right. He says, but it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. See, you're upset. I'm not. It has nothing to do with the facts. You know, the Apostle Paul said, I learned the secret. He called it the secret. I learned how to be content in all things. I've been rich, I've been poor, I've been in jail and not in jail. My circumstances mean nothing to me. Whether my wife's in a bad mood or a good mood, whether the judge likes me, whether the boss likes me or not, whether I have money, whether I don't have money, I act the same way and I feel the same way about myself, no matter what my external circumstances are, because my entire life and who I am is based upon my relationship with God. Now, at 9 years sober, I still hadn't gotten that thing. I'd been working on that thing because I'd been working on the steps, but after 9 years, I had not even made that much progress as when I had 1 year. You understand? And now I'm here to tell you that'll change. That changed for me big time. I went through a lot of changes with that, especially with my wife. With my wife, it's not perfect yet. You understand what I'm saying? It's not perfect, but that's, you know what that is? That's alcoholism. That's what I deal with. I'm going to tell you two fast stories about something that happened in the last month. With the last month. I love telling, you know, it says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like. The magic is in the stories. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, you don't have to make up shit or think about stuff. You just got to talk about what happened to you yesterday. You know what I mean? Because if you're an alcoholic, anything that happened to you, in any, you know, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. No matter what the cause, you know, no matter what you go through what you tell, somewhere in there is a lesson about alcoholism, your disease, what's going on, and how you can get relief and how you've changed. It's all there. And these are two stories that happened. They just happened to me. It was just amazing stuff as the power of this program and the power to deal with life on life's terms. It was my wife's I'm not going to tell you what birthday it was, but, you know, she's only a few years younger than me, although she said it was her 45th birthday. And so I said, well, what do you want to do on your 45th birthday? He says, well, I want to go out with the kids and the grandkids. Now, you got to understand, for me to take out the kids and the grandkids and everybody, it's like taking out the army. You know what I mean? It's like 15 people, you know. We're talking about, and, you know, she wants to go out. I said, well, where do you want to go? And she says, well, what would be the most expensive restaurant in Miami? You know what I mean? And then she goes from there. And so she picks this hugely expensive restaurant. And we invite I invite my three daughters and my son-in-laws and the grandkids, and we all go there to this restaurant. And you know, God bless, you know, I have a decent job and I make money and I can afford it, but I'm not a multi-gazillionaire, you know what I mean? And, you know, I'm happy to take them out and I'm having a good time and it's great. And my wife is having, and everybody's having a wonderful time. And, you know, my kid, you got to understand my kids. You know, my little, you know, 6-year-old Andrea, 5-year-old Andrea is saying, can I have a shrimp cocktail? Sure, Grandpa will pay for it. Yeah, bring another bottle of wine. Don't worry about it. Yeah, just like, and you know, although I'm not worried about the money, you know, my mind is like going like this. Well, that's $150. Well, that's $200. I mean, I'm like a cash register. My mind is like going, how much is this thing going to cost me? You know what I mean? You know, I'm going through my mind and, you know, but I'm cool. I'm okay. I'm saying, thank you, Lord. Thank you, God. You know, I'm glad I can do this and everything like that. So I'm nice and everybody's having a good time. So I'm driving home and in my car is myself and my wife and my daughter, Vanessa, you know, and one of my granddaughters, you know, and Vanessa's a beautiful gal and she's, you know, and she's my favorite middle daughter and she's a tough bunny, you know, but she's sensitive. She's got a great spirit. And I said, you know, I'm out of coffee, and I'm a coffeeaholic. You know, and I'm a and I need the real deal. I need like the stuff, like the classic stuff you're serving here, or even beyond that. You know, Colombian or whatever. I need the. I'm telling you, I need the industrial strength. You know, put the meth in it. I don't give a shit. I need coffee. You know, that is decaf crap. You know, and so I say I'm out of coffee, and Vanessa says, I'll get you the, I'll get it, Dad. Pull up to Publix, and I'll get you the coffee. I'll go and get it. I said, well, you sure? He says, absolutely, Dad. What am I? I'll get you the coffee. So I say, now, Vanessa, listen to me. It's very important. The only coffee I drink is the Colombian Gold, you know, classic Folgers coffee. That's the only coffee I drink. I said, so please get that coffee. He says, Dad, I'm not stupid. I understand. I said, you understand it's the Colombian Gold? He says, I understand. I said, I'm not stupid. Don't tell me again. You know what I mean? Don't tell me again. Don't insult my intelligence, okay? So she runs in there. She grabs the thing. She runs out. It's in the bag. She throws it in the car. She says, I got it. I said, thank you very much. I drive her home. I drive with my house. It's like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I take it out of the thing. It's breakfast blend. Let me explain something to you. If you look at one of the Folgers thing over there, they have an arrow that shows you how strong it is. Like the arrow will point to like brown or black. Black, you drink it and you die. You know what I mean? It's like, that's the stuff I want, okay? This stuff, it was pointing like to yellow. I don't even know what this is like. I don't know what this crap is. You know what I mean? I am freaking out. I just spent, I don't even want to tell you how much the money was. I just spent a ton of freaking money on my wife's birthday on taking all these people out, wining them and dining their ass. You know what I mean? Driving them, all that sort of stuff. And I asked for one thing, one thing, coffee. Colombian dark coffee, the only flippin' thing I asked for, a Colombian dark coffee, and she brings me this breakfast club horseshit. So here's what's happening. You know, I mean, I got to tell you something. I was disappointed. I was upset. I was fucking pissed. You know what I mean? I mean, you don't know what it's like. Let me tell you something. You know what I mean? And it's like she didn't even give a shit. You know what I mean? She didn't give a crap. You know what I mean? It's like, who the fuck? It's like disrespect. Forget it. And so I was going to pick up the phone, you know, I mean, and tell her, you know, I wasn't going to fight with her. I wasn't going to call and I was going to say, I just want you to know that I asked you for one lousy thing, one thing, you know what I mean? The coffee, and you brought me this breakfast club stuff, you know, that I don't even drink, you know what I mean? And I'm going to tell her that because number one, it's right. Number two, I'm right. Number two, she's wrong. And number three, it's, you know, I mean, the fucking galaxies will come together and clash and blow up unless things are set right. And the right thing to do is she's got to know that she screwed up and she did this to me. You understand what I'm saying? And she's got to know now at 11 o'clock at night. Now, I got to tell you something. If you know anything about my daughter, Vanessa, who's somewhat like my wife, the conversation, if I had made it, probably wouldn't have gone well, okay? Because what she would have heard me say is, you're a piece of shit. She would have heard her father tell her she's an idiot and she's a piece of shit and that I hate you. Now, I may not have said that, but that's what she would have heard. And let me tell you something, little girls and little boys don't need their parents telling them they're worthless pieces of shit. Because the coffee ain't that important. And maybe God wants me to drink the yellow shit. I don't know. So I didn't make the coffee and she's never heard of it, you know? But that's alcoholism. And it's also an example of sobriety. It's an example of emotional sobriety, which Bill Wilson called the next frontier. It says our real problem is unhealthy dependencies on other people and other things. You know, that's an example of what this program means. That's the real deal. That's the real sobriety. And the last story I'm going to tell you, because it just happened a week ago, I have another daughter named Alexandra. This has to do with perception and alcohol and our disease. And I work this thing. You know, I mean, I sponsor people. I do it by the numbers. You know, it doesn't matter how sober you are. Let me tell you something. I have a first nature and I have a second nature. My first nature, no matter how long I'll be sober, will always sound like this. I can't fucking believe what just happened. No matter how many meetings I go to, when the yellow shit comes out, my first nature will be, I don't freaking believe this. And my first nature will tell me, send the email, make the phone call, you know, beat them over the head with a mallet, kill them, blow them up. And what AA has done for me, what God has done for me, and being able to focus on Him, has given me the ability to not only stop drinking, but not do that. Sometimes I think I'm doing it so well, or I feel so good, I feel like I've gone through escape velocity, and I'm only working on my second nature. You know, like I'm just no longer an alcoholic. But sure enough, usually something will happen. They'll tell me I still got that craziness in me. And I'll end up doing something that's completely different. It's my second nature. It's they talk about being reborn. They say if you make this decision, a sincere decision for God, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful, He's not the higher power, He's the highest power. Being all powerful, He gives you everything you need if you stay close to Him and perform His works right. Stay close to Him and perform His works. You got to know who He is. In order to stay close to Him, you got to know what His works are. And believe me, His works have nothing to do with the shit I want to do. It has nothing to do with getting laid or any of that stuff. His works have to do with helping other people. That's why the leaders are servants. We got leaders in here. They're servants. They serve. You know, from years and years and years, I went to AA meetings. You know, I need AA meetings like anybody else. For years and years and years, I went to AA meetings because I needed a meeting. And one day I found myself going to AA meetings because I wanted to help other people. One day I found myself going to meetings because I thought there might be people in there that I could help, you know. And there's a little bit of a difference. One day you'll experience when you love going to AA meetings, and the reason you love going to it because there's people there like you that say, maybe I can say something that might help another alcoholic. When you devote your life to that, because that's what our book says. Our job is to be of maximum service. A kindly act once in a while ain't enough. You got that, a kindly act once in a while, it ain't enough. So what happened in the second story is I like to eat, okay? I bought myself a pie, a cherry pie. And only myself and my wife live in the house, but, you know, the kids come by, the girls come by, they have keys and everything like that. And I had a slice of pie, and I set it on top of the stove. And I went into my office. I'm in my law office, and I'm on the phone, and I'm doing this stuff, and I'm business. And I get a call from my daughter, lovely daughter, my youngest daughter, Alexandra. And she says, this is the true story. You know, you can't make this shit up. She says, Dad, is the pie still on the stove? And I mean, I'm in the middle of working. I'm doing stuff. I mean, guys are going to jail. I said, I'm sorry, what? Is the pie still on the fire? I said, what do you, the pie. Is the pie, is it still on the, I said, the pie. Vanessa, I mean, Alex, I'm in the middle of doing something. He says, the pie. He says, yeah, I left this one. The pie was on the stove. He says, you still have it? He says, yeah, it's still on the stove. He says, didn't it taste funny? So what are you talking about? I said, didn't it taste? I said, I don't know. No, it didn't taste funny. He says, you didn't taste funny? And I started thinking, it tastes a little funny. He says, yeah, because I poured salt all over it. I said, I'm saying, what? He says, yeah, I went in there last night. I poured salt all over the pie. And I felt, you know, I felt that first nature come, you know, the first nature. She came to my house, poisoned my fucking food. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I brought her into this world. I could take her out. I don't think any jury in the world would convict me. Who does shit like that? And I felt myself about to say, and I was going to use the F word real strong a couple of times. You know what? And I said, I can't talk to you now. Let me call you back. And I hung up the phone. And I went through the... I can't believe this fucking, how could she do this sort of thing? I went through the, you know, the lynch mob killer. I can't believe this fucking bullshit. I went through what we go through. And then I started thinking that these girls love me so much and she loves me so much. You see, they're vegans. They're worried about me having a heart attack. They're loving me, they worry about me getting diabetes. They're always talking to me about my eating. And they're like their mother. They love to regulate me. They're Al-Anoners. You know what I mean? You know, they want me under their control. You know, because I'm incorrigible and I don't follow directions. And you know how we don't like being told what to do. And what she did is because she loved me so much, she went in and she poured salt all over the thing so that I wouldn't be able to eat it. You know, I started thinking about how incredibly blessed it is to have kids that love you that much. And I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I talk to guys all the time that haven't seen their kids in 10 years. Or the kids hate them or stuff like that. And my kids love me. You know? And so I started thinking, what a great deal. What a wonderful gal she is. So the next time I saw her, I just told her, I said, I love you. I just want you to know I love you. You know? All that stuff is an example of alcoholism and sobriety and action and what goes on here. This is the deal. We can talk about it, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank. But there's a reason people at 10 years, at 41 years, at 55 years, at 20 years still go to meetings, and it's not because of the drinking thing that they had, you know, 41 years ago. It's because of that stuff. It's about, you know, that kind of stuff. That's what it's about. You know, it's about that stuff. And so I'm so blessed to be here with you guys, and God bless you all.